If you'd met Daisy Coleman, you would have believed that she had it all. Beauty, talent, intelligence, and a strong desire to always help others. Tragically though, underneath all of that was a truly battered soul who had gone through horrific things that no one should ever have to, and especially not someone so young. Having seen the dark side of humanity, despite fighting hard, she simply couldn't find her way back into the light. Today's case is truly heartbreaking. Hey Coffee and Crimers, I'm your host, Belle Fagan. It was a few minutes before 5 a.m. on January the 8th, 2012, in the small town of Maryville, Missouri. The local vet, Melinda Coleman, was woken by a sound outside. Her and her four kids had moved to the small town after her husband had been killed in a car accident. Back in 2009, her husband, her daughter, and one of her sons had been travelling to watch the other son in a wrestling competition when their car had hit black ice, crashed into a ravine, and killed her husband, Michael, instantly. Now, we've all been woken up by random noises, and generally we go back to sleep, right? But every now and again, we'll hear something that makes us get up and check. And what Melinda heard made her get up and check. When she opened the front door and peered outside, she was shocked to see her 14-year-old daughter Daisy, shoeless and only wearing a t-shirt and leggings, unconscious, laying in the thick snow. She yelled for her sons and she scooped up her ice-cold daughter and brought her into the house. She had no idea how long Daisy'd been laying out in that freezing cold, but she knew that it had been a fair while because Daisy's hair was frozen and stuck to the ground. Immediately wrapping her in blankets, just trying to get her body temperature back up to anything that kind of resembled normal, she decided that maybe a hot bath would help. And it was then that she noticed severe bruising on Daisy's inner thighs. And her first thought is exactly, I'm sure, what you're all thinking. Had Daisy been sexually assaulted? Melinda wrapped her back up and rushed her to the hospital. And once there, the local sheriff's office was also called. What the Coleman family couldn't have known at the time was that they were about to begin a journey to hell and back. Actually, just scrap that. Straight to hell. No back. The justice system would fail them massively, with Daisy, the victim, okay, the victim, being painted as a sexual tease who got exactly what she deserved. So buckle up. A rape kit was carried out along with a bunch of lab tests, and one of those tests showed that Daisy's blood alcohol level was 134.9, which was nearly twice the legal limit. And obviously by now it's late morning, so she hadn't had anything to drink, obviously, for hours. So the fact that she was still legally drunk now meant that she would have basically been comatose before she even ended up on her family's front lawn. Still having that amount of alcohol in her system, although she was awake, Daisy wasn't in any fit state to give a statement about what exactly had happened the previous night. So it was all down to her best friend Paige to fill in the blanks for both Melinda and the cops. Despite being scared and in shock herself, 13-year-old Paige managed to tell authorities that she and Daisy had gone to a small get-together at the home of the town's star football player. Once inside, they discovered that they were the only girls there amongst a group of boys. Melinda's thinking, hang on a minute, okay, she was meant to be having a sleepover with Daisy, so how the heck had these two young girls ended up at essentially a frat party? So the cops tell her to start from the beginning, and she does. She tells them that the sleepover at Daisy's house had kicked off with the two of them sneaking a few sips of booze from the family's liquor cabinet. Their aim wasn't to get drunk, they just wanted to see what all the fuss about alcohol was. Now, if you've got older siblings, we've been there, okay? I've got an older brother, 4 years older, he did everything obviously before me, and you just want to be the older, cool kid. So they carry on their evening together when Daisy starts exchanging text messages back and forth with 17-year-old Matt Barnett, a friend of her older brother Charlie. Matt invites the girls over to his house for a few drinks. Again, we've all been there, okay? You're 14 and a 17-year-old boy is flirting with you. Of course, you're going to be as giddy as Daisy was. But obviously now, as grown-ass women, we're like, what the heck is a 17-year-old boy wanting with a 13 and a 14-year-old girl? But the two girls are thinking that they've just hit the social jackpot and they jumped at the chance to hang out with the older, cooler kids. So they sneak out of Daisy's bedroom window and meet up with Matt and his buddies, who are waiting for them around the corner. Getting to his house, they all make their way to the basement, where Matt is basically shushing everyone so that they won't wake his parents. According to Paige, the minute the door closed behind them, Matt began plying Daisy with drinks. She said that as her friend downed shot after shot, a 15-year-old boy had taken her, so had taken Paige, by the hand and into a side room. Alone, the boy began forcing himself onto Paige, who repeatedly told him to stop. Ignoring her, he had pinned her down and raped her, all while she sobbed and pleaded with him to let her go. When it was finally over, Paige ran back into the other room. Most of the boys were still there, but Matt and Daisy were missing. Hearing noises in the next adjoining room, she peeked through the crack in the door and saw Daisy laying half on the bed and half off, barely conscious, mumbling words that Paige couldn't make out. And her body was limp. She was also naked from the waist down, and so was Matt. Paige stayed in the main room, and a few minutes later, both Matt and Daisy came out of the room fully dressed. Matt appeared completely clear-headed and steady on his feet, but Daisy was so inebriated that she couldn't even stand without help. The girls were immediately led to Matt's car and driven home. When they pulled up in front of Daisy's house, one of the boys told Paige to go get some sleep, and they promised her that they would stay with Daisy, who was still too out of it to walk, until she sobered up. Now, I know we're screaming, guys, but her 13-year-old naivety meant that she took them at their word. So she went back inside and slipped into bed. As soon as Paige was back in the house, the boys had taken Daisy out of the car and dumped her on the lawn, knowing that the sun would be up any minute and they didn't want to risk being seen slash caught, so they simply drove off without a care in the world. It was while she was in hospital with her mum that Daisy's brother Charlie discovered her phone buried in the snow. When he checked her messages, he found the texts between his sister and the person that he'd considered a friend up until that point. And knowing Matt like he did, he knew 100%, zero doubt in his mind, that Paige was telling the truth.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction. And free shipping. And that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements. Featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
On the afternoon of January 8th, Matt Barnett was brought in for questioning. And you won't be shocked when I tell you that his version was completely different to Paige's. He said that Daisy had begged to come over that night, and he'd given in because she wouldn't quit. He insisted that he hadn't offered her anything to drink until after they had finished what he said was consensual sex. Yes, she was tipsy when she arrived at the party, he said, but not enough that she hadn't known exactly what was happening and had been a willing participant. Like all scumbags, though, the more he talked, the more his story changed. First, he said he had no idea who Paige was, but then later on, he mentioned Paige by name. When the investigators pointed this out to him, he just shrugged it off. He then also backtracked on the whole alcohol thing. Remember, he said he'd given her nothing until after they'd slept together. Conveniently, he suddenly remembers that actually he had given her a couple of drinks. You know, just to break the ice. What a guy. The deputy who carried out Matt's interview couldn't have been more sympathetic to Matt if he'd tried. I'm talking so relaxed that he was literally laying back in his chair. And then, when Matt told him how he'd dropped Daisy off at his house at the end of the night, the sheriff praised him for making sure that she'd gotten home safely. The fact that he just dumped her on the frozen lawn hadn't even raised an eyebrow on this guy. What an actual waste of space. One of the other boys, Jordan Zeck, was also interviewed, and he admitted that he had filmed Matt and Daisy having sex through a crack in the door, but said that he had now deleted the footage. All a little bit too convenient, if you ask me. If you're going to be freaky-deaky enough to film a supposedly consensual couple, why would you then delete it once the police come knocking? Especially if the sexual encounter was mutual, like Matt was claiming, because the video would completely work to his advantage and clear all of this up. But as is going to be the common theme in this case, the authorities didn't see it that way. By the end of the day, Matt Barnett was placed under arrest for the sexual assault of Daisy. Jordan Zeck was also charged with one count of sexual exploitation of a minor for filming the incident. A third boy, a 15-year-old, who had allegedly raped Paige, had his identity protected due to being a minor, but he was also taken into custody. Thankfully, the potentially fatal amount of alcohol wore off, and Daisy was able to remember only snippets of what had happened in the side room just off the basement. She couldn't remember every detail, but she did know that she had been plied with an insane amount of alcohol. And not being used to the effects of alcohol, she hadn't realised that she was in over her head until it was too late. Okay, we really do need to keep reminding ourselves that these girls were 13 and 14. So they really don't have any clue that alcohol is going to get them drunk as quick as it did. She had zero memory of even having sex with Matt, whether consensual or not. Her last memory had been sitting on the couch and having a dog jump up on her lap just before she passed out. The next thing she remembered was waking up in the hospital with the police and her mum by her side. Like, I mean, surely the results speak for themselves. The bruising, the sheer volume of alcohol in her system. But no, not to police, especially not to the sheriff that we mentioned earlier, but we're going to come back to that. So we know that Matt has vehemently denied any wrongdoing, but the boy who had raped Paige had pleaded guilty to the charges against him. He admitted that not only had she told him no several times, but also that it had been super obvious from the get-go that she was drunk up to her eyeballs. His plea was accepted and he was sentenced to a juvenile facility. As any kid would, Daisy just wanted everything to go back to normal. So while the case against Matt was still being investigated, she went back to school, understandably thinking that her classmates would all support her. But instead, she was bullied relentlessly. Matt was the school's star athlete and his family were prominent in the small town. So instead of trying to see the truth in her story, the majority of students had chosen to rally around him, while simultaneously making Daisy's life a living hell. She was branded a slut and a liar, but not just by random students, but ones that she thought were her friends. Her brother Charlie, who had obviously cut ties with Matt and the other boys, did his best to protect her, but the damage was already being done. As each day passed, she was worn down more and more by the non-stop harassment. And where she was once a super outgoing, popular cheerleader, she was now a shell of the old Daisy. So let's get back to the sheriff that we mentioned earlier. This is a man who had sworn an oath to be an impartial upholder of the law. But instead, Sheriff Darren White hadn't hidden the fact that his empathy laid squarely with the accused boys. Yep, he was on Matt's side. In an interview back in 2016, he had moaned about the fact that the boys had been persecuted by Daisy's supporters when all they wanted to do was put the ordeal behind them and move on with their lives. And he was quoted as saying, "Girls have as much culpability in cases like Daisy's." I honestly have no words. But Daisy, Paige and their families wouldn't let the matter drop. Cry me a freaking river, Darren. Damn right they weren't going to let it drop. The interviewer said, "Well, have you ever thought that they wouldn't let it drop because maybe the boys are actually rapists and the girls are the victims?" And what do you reckon his answer was? He just laughed at the idea. He then said that girls tended to do these kind of things for attention, and this was very likely to have been one of those times. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty sure your blood is boiling as much as mine. I mean, this guy, this cop, wouldn't even entertain any other theory other than the one that the girls were being nothing more than attention seekers. Despite the fact that there was evidence to the contrary. He argued that the evidence didn't firmly categorise what had allegedly occurred in Matt's basement as rape. I mean, he really is out there giving grown men a bad name. He couldn't see the indisputable fact that Daisy was a child of 14 who had consumed so much alcohol that she couldn't walk or even put together a coherent sentence, let alone consent to sex. It was all just completely lost on him. In another interview, he told reporters that the alleged victims and their families had refused to cooperate with authorities, making it nearly impossible for them to conduct a thorough investigation. Again, Daisy and Paige's family and friends were gobsmacked. He was delusional because both the Colemans and the Parkhursts had been the ones pushing him to do his job from the get-go. Like, Melinda was down at that police station daily. And someone really needed to gag this idiot because he obviously was completely unable to quit while he was ahead. Because again, he flaps his gums and suggested that Melinda Coleman, so Daisy's mum, enjoyed playing the part of a poor victim. Excuse me? Like, in what parallel universe does a parent who believes their child has been viciously assaulted not demand that the perp be brought to justice? And I, for one, wouldn't rest until justice was served. But this widowed mother, who had always put the well-being of her kids above everyone else, wasn't going to let anyone, not even a piece of garbage with a badge, stand in her way. After months of being told that it was only a matter of time before a court date for Matt would be set, in 2013, the Colemans were told that instead, the charges against Matt and Jordan had been dismissed. Authorities said that Daisy had made an admission in her initial statement that had made them decide not to move forward with the case. Frankly, she'd purposely been tripped up, in my opinion. When she was asked if there was any chance that she had told the boys that she would trade sexual favours in exchange for booze, Daisy had replied that she guessed it was possible. Knowing that a defence attorney would have had a field day with that, the state had thought it best to just dismiss the whole thing. Even though Paige said that there was no exchange like that ever made, the damage had been done as far as they were concerned. I mean, it's just devastating. It really is truly devastating. She's a literal kid who has been through huge trauma, experiencing memory loss, and of all the things that she said, that's the one they cling on to. Any prosecutor worth their salt could have found a way around what she said. But frankly, the odds hadn't been in Daisy's favour from the start, and it wasn't lost on her supporters that Matt's grandfather, Rex Barnett, was a former law enforcement officer and a state representative, meaning he very well could influence the decision for the prosecutors to drop the case. With no trial, it was simply a he said, she said situation, which divided the public and left them to decide for themselves if the alleged perpetrator's town and legal connections had played a role in his charges being dismissed. Obviously reeling from this devastating decision, the already shell-like Daisy just became more and more despondent. Still being relentlessly bullied in person and online, she finally reached breaking point. She attempted suicide on four separate occasions, and her family became so worried about her mental state that they actually removed all the doors from the hinges so that they could see her at all times. The bullying wasn't just verbal or written either. One night while the family was away, their house was set on fire. Thankfully, that did mean that no one was harmed, but it was then that they realised that they couldn't wait around until eventually one of them was harmed. They were no longer safe in Maryville, so they moved to a neighbouring community where thankfully the residents were a bit more welcoming. On the surface, it did look like most of Maryville had fallen in line behind Matt and his family. But there were a few non-biased citizens who truly believed that the system had let Daisy down. Local newspapers released editorials criticising the way that the investigation had been handled, and before long, the influential internet vigilante group Anonymous took up the case. After demanding justice for Daisy, Missouri authorities finally stepped up. Giving in to the pressure, Maryville officials announced that a new prosecutor would be reopening the investigation. But sadly, don't get excited, guys, because obviously everyone's hopes were raised, but it never went anywhere. After reviewing the evidence, none of the felony charges were reinstated. Again, okay, there's a new prosecutor, but that doesn't change the fact that Matt's grandfather has a lot of sway in the town. Instead of being held accountable for rape, Matthew Barnett pleaded guilty to the misdemeanor offence of second-degree child endangerment for leaving Daisy in the snow. And his punishment? It was a 4-month suspended sentence, meaning that he didn't spend one single night inside a jail cell. He was also put on 2 years probation, during which he wasn't allowed to drink alcohol, and he also had to carry out community service, undergo random drug testing, and pay the Coleman family the sum of $1,800 in restitution. Frankly, that figure is an insult, and I would have said just keep it and stick it where the sun don't shine. Despite the bullying, Daisy did graduate from high school, and being an amazing artist and athlete, she received a scholarship to Missouri Valley College. In 2016, Netflix made a documentary called Audrey and Daisy. Now, it's won a whole heap of awards and it's been hailed as a truly fantastic documentary, so definitely go give it a watch. It highlighted Daisy's case and the case of 15-year-old Audrey Pott. The documentary followed their outcomes through time, social media, court documents, and police investigations. Audrey had been sexually assaulted at a high school gathering where she was stripped bare, drawn on, photographed, and penetrated by 3 high school boys. Just like Daisy, she'd then been bullied and blamed, and only 9 days after her ordeal, she took her own life. Essentially, the framework of the documentary was that one girl survived and one did not. And I don't know, to me looking at it, that just doesn't seem fair now to either girl. The documentary interviews 2 of Audrey's bullies, who frankly don't appear to have learned anything at all from the situation. Audrey's parents are also interviewed and try to get across Audrey's character and uniqueness as a person. But because Daisy herself is there to be interviewed, the depth of the after effects is easier for the viewers to grasp. The documentary followed Daisy for over 2 years, allowing viewers to see her through different phases. The narrative arc of the film is about mutual rescue. Daisy joined a group of survivors who were assaulted at a similar phase in their lives while in school, and they were all disbelieved, and together they all helped one another by dealing with the sense of isolation, the social rejection, and the self-doubt. And I don't know, but to me, the whole documentary kind of has an implication that things might have turned out differently for Audrey if she'd found a similar community. This is just my opinion, but I do wonder if almost pitting their stories against each other could have made any feelings of survivorship turn into survivor guilt for Daisy. And you remember earlier when I said that the sheriff was quoted in an interview as saying girls have as much culpability in cases like Daisy's? Well, that was in this documentary, which means that it's in this documentary that the filmmakers alleged that the boys in Daisy and her friend Paige's case were guilty, that he replied with a chuckle. And at the end of that chuckle, he said, "Were they?" I mean, this guy seriously needs karma to bite him squarely in the butt. And I'm not naive to the fact that clever editing can make someone's words appear completely out of context. And yes, he wasn't the one who dropped the charges against the boys. But on the flip side, I've researched many cases where the lead investigator goes above and beyond to get justice for the victim or victims, and I found nothing to suggest that Darren White did any more than the bare minimum. And I'm not even sure he really did the bare minimum. In 2018, the filming wrapped, and with the hope of starting a new life far away from Maryville, Daisy relocated to Colorado to become a tattoo artist. The PTSD obviously hadn't gone, but she truly did want to move on and finally have a happy future. But sadly, that wasn't to be. In the June of that same year, more tragedy struck. Daisy's brother Tristan and her mum Melinda were involved in a single vehicle accident while they were helping Daisy move. Melinda sustained serious but non-life-threatening injuries, but devastatingly, 19-year-old Tristan was killed on impact. To lose two members of your family to car accidents in a decade is just heartbreaking. Daisy and her other brother Charlie, the one who had tried to protect her at school, decided to co-found a charity named Safe Bay, which stands for Safe Before Anyone Else. They created an organisation to provide teenagers with the tools that they needed to spot predatory behaviour among their fellow peers and how to act accordingly. It also aims to empower at-risk age groups through social and educational programmes. Daisy's role was as a victims' rights advocate, so she began publicly sharing her story in the hopes of helping teenage girls who might find themselves in similar situations. Once again, though, because she refused to hide away, her outspokenness brought out the internet trolls. But this badass persevered and spread the word to anyone willing to listen, reminding them that there was no shame in doing the right thing, and she really did work tirelessly on behalf of others. But as much as I'm in awe of her, I'm also desperately aware that it would have meant that the demons of her past would never have been far from her memory. And in the summer of 2020, those demons finally caught up with her. At around 4 o'clock in the afternoon of August 4th, Melinda had contacted authorities in Denver and asked them to perform a welfare check on Daisy, as she had noticed that Daisy's suicidal tendencies had begun rearing their head again. A couple of weeks previously, she'd been told that she was unable to have children, which could have been an after effect of the rape, seeing as she was so young. When they got to Daisy's apartment, they witnessed no signs that she was in danger of harming herself or anyone else. But they did take Melinda's fear seriously, and to be on the safe side, a crisis prevention agent came and spent an hour assessing the situation. After being satisfied that all was well, they left. And only an hour or so later, Daisy Coleman put a gun to her head and pulled the trigger. At 8:30 p.m., at the age of only 23, she was pronounced dead. In the wake of her death, a friend of Daisy's had come forward to say that Daisy had been the target of a stalker. Apparently, a man who Daisy kind of knew had been hounding her in the weeks leading up to her suicide, even turning up to her house the day before her death, threatening to kidnap her and sell her into the sex slavery trade. The friend said that she had gone to the local authorities and lodged a report, but the authorities in question have refused to either confirm or deny the allegations. And I don't know if this has ever been followed up since, but it doesn't appear on any public record. And what about our buddy, good old Maryville Sheriff Darren White? Well, when he was informed of Daisy's passing, he had initially offered his sympathies to her remaining family. Now, incidentally, at the time, he was also running for office again, as he had lost out on re-election back in 2016. And he had lost out on that re-election after the things that he'd said in the documentary. Damn right. As voting day approached, though, he all of a sudden took those sympathies back and publicly put it out there that Daisy had purposely timed the killing of herself because she knew that it would bring her case back to the forefront and squash his chances of winning. This guy, oh my goodness. Now, I don't want to belittle her trauma in any way, but if she did time it that way, then I would frankly applaud her because that, I have no words, deserves to step on Lego barefoot for the rest of his freaking days. Once again, though, with his disgusting true nature revealed to all, His opponent won by a landslide, and yet again, he wasn't re-elected. Heck yes. Now, sadly, life wasn't finished being exceptionally cruel to this family, because 4 months after Daisy's death, 58-year-old Melinda Coleman posted on social media touching remembrance posts of her daughter. She then picked up a pistol and ended her own life too. Her son Logan tragically found her body. Before her death, she had never stopped being vocal that Daisy had never gotten over the sexual assault, the public scrutiny, and the bullying that both she and her loved ones had been subjected to. She had tried so hard to hang on for her other sons, but the severe depression over losing Daisy, compounded with the previous losses of her husband and her son Tristan, were just too much to overcome. As for Matt Barnett, after graduating and after his pathetically short probation time, he had gone to Northwest Missouri State University, and he did go on record expressing his sadness at both Daisy and Melinda's deaths. And since then, he's gone on to be successful in his field with a steady girlfriend by his side, and to all appearances looks like to be living the dream. Safe Bay, Daisy's legacy, is still going strong thanks to her brother Charlie, determined to make sure that no other victims of teenage sexual abuse are forced to face the backlash that crushed his sister's spirit. He has become a champion of those out there needing to be heard. And I'm sure you'll all be with me in wanting nothing but happiness for both Logan and Charlie, the remaining two out of the once family of five. But before we end today's episode, I want to read an extract from a website, an organisation called thegeminiproject.org. And it's all about victim blaming in today's world. And this is on their main page, so you can read this too, but I will just read it out to you. It says, whilst many believe that a victim of sexual violence may have provoked rape and sexual abuse, we all really know that that is BS. No one invites violence against themselves, and no one chooses to live with the effects sexual violence has on one's psyche, perceptions, and life. The definition of rape is sex without consent. The victim had no choice in the matter and was subjected to sexual violence against their will. Attributing any blame onto the victim only shifts the focus away from the perpetrator and thus takes responsibility away from the person who committed the crime, which is exceptionally damaging when trying to pursue justice. The idea that a victim should have any control over what transpired is a myth that is too often used against victims to justify heinous crimes. The sad thing is, people listen and believe these myths because it's easier to believe that someone could be at fault or lying than it is to believe that someone they know could be capable of rape. Defence lawyers of perpetrators often get rapists off by using victim blaming in their line of argument, as it plays into the societal myths and falsehoods already held by the jury, who wouldn't want to ruin a young man's life. This way of thinking is incredibly damaging to victims, and for many is one of the main reasons they choose not to report what happened to them. It ends with, do not shift the blame from the perpetrator to the victim. Rape is never deserved, never asked for, and never the victim's fault. To see today's case photos, click on the link in the case description to join the Cup of Coffee and Crime Facebook discussion group. I've also listed different resources for survivors of sexual abuse in today's bio. Until next week, stay safe.